I'm Alexis.
And I'm Alexandra.
And this is Shoujo Mojo. It's an anime podcast proving that women can be weebs too.
Each week, we discuss an anime or two.
Or three.
And dive into the topics you care most about.
This week, we will be discussing Demon Slayer.
Yes.
Yeah, and this is actually going to be part one of a part two series because we just had way too much that we wanted to discuss, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different layers and things that we can discuss, from why they selected the Taisho era to why are there demons to where do Oni and like Japanese folklore lie, like why do they believe in them? Do they really believe in them?
Oh yeah. Yeah, well, a very interesting distinction that I know about like certain types of folklore with Japanese is the idea of ghosts versus monsters. I think in American cinema, like, we'll think of ghosts as like really scary things, but in Japan it's called obake, which are kind of like little stupid ghosts, kind of like little stupid spirit ghosts that like are not a threat at all. They're kind of more like you brush them aside or whatever, whereas bakemono is like monster, and that's like scary. Thing.
Well, the first one's kind of like in Psyche K, where there's like the ghost and they're like, oh, can you like help me? And he just like ignores them, like doesn't even acknowledge their existence.
Yeah. Oh, man. So maybe one of the layers that we could start peeling back is just the name of Demon Slayer. So in Japanese, it's Kimetsu no Yaiba. So I wanted to just talk about this really quickly because Kimetsu is a combination of the kanji oni, or demon, and the character for destruction, also known as horo. So Kimetsu no Yaiba is like demon destruction. The Yaiba means blade. So when you put it all together, Kimetsu no Yaiba means the blade of demon destruction.
That's, whoa.
Yeah, so that's the true name of the show.
Does that directly correlate to Tanjiro's sword, or just the weapon that they all use for the demons?
Ooh, that's such a good question. I bet it's the weapon
that
they
all
use.
His was so unique because it has a black core.
Yeah, that was so cool.
I know.
Yeah, I don't know, because the sword is made by that one guy, or his, and his apprentice as well, and they all have a different color stripe that goes up their sword. So I don't know, but it probably is like it probably is both. Like, it references Tanjiro because he's on his, like, destiny quest. So good.
It feels so much, like, it definitely feels a bit like Mushishi whenever I watch it. Like, just the lone guy going around trying to, like, get rid of these demons.
Yeah, well,
I wonder what era that's set in.
Mushishi?
Yeah.
I don't know. I never watched it, even though I really wanted to, because Travis Willingham did the English voiceover for it. I wanted to see it for that reason and that reason alone, but I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, so they actually created an era between the Edo and the Meiji era.
For Mushishi.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, that actually brings me to something else that we wanted to discuss, was we wanted to just give like a short history of the more modern timeline for Japanese history and all the different eras, and how maybe give a little context to the Taisho period, which is where Demon Slayer takes place.
Yes.
So what would be called early modern Japan starts with the Edo period, which was from around 1600 to 1868. Fun fact, Rurouni Kenshin takes place in the 12th year of the Edo period. At the time, it was under tight control of the Tokugawa shogunate. The shogunate is a military dictator of Japan who was appointed by the emperor. So the shogun's officials
were... Well, wasn't the emperor just like the emperor?
Exactly.
In quotes?
Exactly. And that's a great point. Like, the shogunate, those were the people in power. They were appointed by the emperor, quote-unquote, appointed by the emperor. But
it's sad that I only know that because of the history of Japan.
Oh, because of that video. Oh my god, that's a great video. Oh my god. Oh, da na na. Oh man, I loved that video. It's good. Maybe we'll put that online.
It's perfect. Yeah. And it's so, like, Oh, we should post that on the Instagram.
Yeah, we'll reshare it because it's very helpful. It does help put us all into context. The Shogun's officials were referred to by many as the Bakufu, or the Tenti government, and they were the ones who carried out, like, the actual administrative duties of the government, whereas the imperial court, or the emperor, they retained only, like, nominal authority. So, like, the shogunate is where samurai come from, like, keeping the peace, but also breaking some bones and doing some other stuff.
Well, weren't they also, because I know it was explained that people would hire samurai to protect their families, but it was really only the wealthy that could afford to do this.
Exactly, yeah. So, like, they claim that during this Edo period, there was, you know, a period of, like, 250 years of relative peace. But at the same time, there's all these accounts of, like, really harsh penalties that the samurai were carrying out, like crucifixion, beheading, death by boiling, like, they apparently were for minor offenses that they would do this kind of stuff. So it must have been a really stressful time. But the Edo period eventually gave way to the Meiji Restoration, or the Meiji period, which kind of stands for, like, modern restoration. I think that's when a lot of the Japanese saw the change from being a feudal society to having a market economy, and, like, much more Western stuff was coming in. Because I remember in Rurouni Kenshin movie as well, like, a train that's being built.
Oh, wow.
And all the characters are remarking, like, what is this thing? And they're
like... But wait, there's movies?
Yeah, there's a Rurouni Kenshin movie. I think there might be multiple, but I only have seen one, but I remember it
vividly. I need to check that out.
Yeah, it's... I mean, that's a great series. Another great, like, samurai kind of
feel. We definitely need to, in the future, do a samurai episode.
Yeah, like a full-blown-on samurai episode. Yeah, because technically, the Taisho period, that was... There aren't any samurai anymore.
Was, like, it outlawed then? Or yeah, did they just die out?
During the Meiji Restoration, there was an event that restored imperial rule to the Emperor of Japan. This was conducted by Emperor Meiji. That's why it's called the Meiji period. And so that was the end of samurai. Like, the shogunate was dissolved and they returned to imperial rule, essentially. And that kind of leads us into the Taisho period, which is from 1912 to 1945. And that era is known as Great Righteousness, which I found to be interesting. But it's definitely an area where, like, there aren't samurai anymore. Mm-hmm. Or at least there aren't supposed to be. And then that's when you get into, like, the samurai shampoo feeling, which is, like, these samurai who are kind of disbanded, like, everything that they ever built their lives around, like, in their families for generations that they built their lives around, like, no longer they have any power. So they're kind of like wandering swordsmen for hire.
Something that I thought was really interesting was how the emperor was a sickly man, which prompted the shift in political power from the old oligarchic group of elder statesmen, or the genro, to the imperial diet of Japan and the democratic parties, which I believe that's still the political structure of this company, of the country to this day, because I know that there is still the Diet Party. And I know that it's run similar to Parliament, which was from the English influence on the country. Mm. But I know that that got restructured after World War II with mm-hmm. the treaty, mm-hmm. and their constitution was written by America.
Yep. Well, I think it's also cool because during the Taisho period, like, that was coming out of World War I, and it was, Japan was, you know, when they went to the peace conference in Paris, I think it was 1919, they received official recognition as one of the big five nations
yeah.
of the new
it
international
It was 1919.
Order. Oh, good. Okay. Woohoo! Yay! High school history. So during that time, like, Japan, like, is coming out as a national country, like a figurehead leader, which I think is really interesting, and I wonder, like, how that works in going into, like, the Showa period, pre-war and post-war, which is the period that came after the Taisho period, and it spanned before and after World War II.
Something that I find to be really I don't want to say mind-blowing, but it definitely kind of blew my mind. We had the suffragette movement here where women were struggling to get voting rights. And in Japan, there was a male suffrage movement from 1919 to 1920, where there was a call for raised universal suffrage and the dismantling of the old political party network, where you had students, university professors, and journalists bolstered by the labor unions and inspired by a variety of democratic, socialist, communist, Antichrist, and other Western school of thoughts. Yeah, I was like, am I reading that right?
Antichrist.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, good.
Which called about for new elections to be brought upon after they gained the majority.
Yeah. They were, in ways, it was behind,
they
right?
assassinated the old leader in 1921. Which brought the succession of non-party prime ministers and coalition cabinet members.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this was really, like, even though this is noted as, like, a peaceful time, a lot was happening behind the scenes in restructuring of how their society was led.
Yeah. At this time, the term Pan-Asianism became a characteristic term for right-wing politics at that time. And it included the disenchanted former samurai, you know, and they were establishing their own patriotic societies and intelligence gathering organizations, you know, that supported what would be called, you know, ultra-nationalistic causes. And there are still Japanese nationalist parties today where people... when I was in Japan, I saw them. They would be in their white vans. I mean, to be honest, like, when I look at Japanese nationalists compared to U.S. nationalists, I'm much more intimidated by U.S. nationalists, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, the Japanese nationalists that I encountered, they would drive around in these white vans, and they would just blast, like, the national anthem, and they would be flying the sun flag, the Japanese flag that was before World War II, where it was, like, an actual red sun rather than just a red circle. But that's all they would do, is they would drive around, and then they would set up shop, and then they would kind of stand there quietly, you know, like, versus, like, U.S. nationalists here, just, like, you got to be scared for...
Who knows what they'll do.
Yeah, exactly. So I think all of that kind of stuff is really interesting of, like, what's happening. Because it's, like...
It's so volatile when you, like, pull it apart and see what's happening. They even had a Japanese Communist Party, which was founded in 1922, with the goals of the party being defined in 1923 to include the unification of the working class as well as the farmers... They wanted recognition from the Soviet Union and withdrawal of Japanese troops from Siberia, China, Korea, and Taiwan. And it took until 1925 for them to reach a peace preservation law to direct these dangerous thoughts to try to purge them out from Japan.
Wow. It's interesting to kind of have all this context, because we haven't actually even talked about Demon Slayer at all yet. We've only talked about the history, which I think is good for this part one in the show.
Because there's so much going on in this era that Tanjiro kind of finds himself confronting. Because we're just talking about, like, the people within the city. We're not even touching on the fact that he represents the common man in Japan at that time, where really they were disenfranchised, they were facing abject poverty that the country really hadn't seen in a long time. I don't think they experienced poverty like this in the Meiji era, where he would literally have to go into town and try to sell coal to people who probably already had coal.
Oh my god, did you know that the tan in Tanjiro's name means coal?
That's perfect.
I love it. It's like Marion Crane. I think I think that you're raising a great point, right? Because also, you know, his father obviously isn't around at the beginning of the show, we get some flashbacks. Because
he's so sick.
Yeah, because he's sick, and that was so sad. But, like, that's definitely a realistic thing that would happen as well. It's, like, it's interesting to see how Tanjiro would fit into this time period. And then you add the supernatural element on top of that, which takes it just to another level.
It seems like his involvement with the Demon Slayer corpse is definitely ahead of its time, and I don't know if this is near the end of the Taisho era, because this led into, what was the name of the next era?
The Showa period.
Yeah, which is when everybody starts enlisting in the military as a way to gain rank, nobility, and a foundation for their family so that they're no longer starving. Mm. So you see this rush of the young men coming from farmer families enlisting in the military, because during the Taisho era, they were heavily, heavily investing in the military, which is why these farmers kind of became disenfranchised and left behind, because the country no longer saw in importance in supporting the common everyday man, but in the advancement of their society in industrializing and in catching up with the Western world.
For me, when I was watching Demon Slayer, it reminded me so much of Full Metal Alchemist.
Yeah.
Like, somebody whose life completely changed, then their sibling got turned into something that they're not.
Yes.
And the entire premise is trying to return their sibling back to the way that they were. And so they have to grow up much faster than they should. And they enlist in the military. And, you know, the Taisho period was also known as the Jazz Age of Japan because of their fashions, right?
Yeah, I found that to be really fascinating. You notice them really copying off of Western culture, where instead of the kimono coming to their ankle, it would come to, like, their mid-shin, and, like, oh, shock horror, the scandal. Seeing that, like, little extra bit of leg was just so, like, tantalizing. Or they would bring up the hem of their sleeve so that you could see more of the wrist.
Wow.
But that they would call these women the Moga girl, aka the modern girls, where they would follow Westernized fashions and lifestyles in World War I. They were the equivalent of America's flappers, and this era of fashion was characterized by the emergence of working class young women with access to money and consumer goods. They would use aristocratic culture as their standard Japanese-ness, and the critics of the modern girl condemned her working class traits as unnatural or unfeminine for the Japanese man. They commonly lived in cities, and they were financially and emotionally independent. And for the first time, they were starting to choose their own suitors, and they had an interest in politics. Then you had the flourishing of women's magazines, where they were the primary consumers for these. And then you have the beginning of J-beauty and J-fashion, where they would see ads for cosmetics and fashions that closely resembled real life. Instead of it just being like an illustration, it would actually show a woman like them applying the makeups.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's just so fascinating. I'm really curious about J-beauty and K-beauty and its origins. I love supporting various J-beauty and K-beauty brands. But that could be like a whole other episode.
We should
I could
do
just
an episode
rant
that.
About that.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about like all the changes that were happening, right? Like, what about when Tanjiro, like a boy from the country, goes to the city for the first time? I love how they handled that. I thought that it was brilliant. Like, he was overwhelmed. Like, demons, Tanjiro can handle it. He's cool. But the minute he goes to this city, he starts freaking out and, like, can't handle anything.
It's just this hustle, this bustle, the clothing's so different. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised at just how Western they were dressing in the city. Mm. Like, some of the women were so rebellious as to wear pants, which I thought that was only a phenomenon in the American and European countries, not Japan.
Yeah, well, your point about, like, the Taisho period being a period of women empowerment, right? Like, you had mentioned earlier that that's when male suffrage happened, right?
Yeah.
Female suffrage, women's suffrage, didn't happen until after World War II, during the Showa period post-war. But I think that probably that wave, that movement that started then, allowed for the momentum to give women the vote post a war-ravaged country.
Is it possible that male suffrage was a response to there being so many female workers and the men feeling left behind? Because you also have those farmers out there who maybe they can't just pick up, pack up, and leave and go to the city to get these jobs. But then they see all these MOGA girls all over the news, all over their newspapers, talking about how successful they are, like how they can now choose their own partners. So now it's not marriages of benefit anymore. Mm. So perhaps the media was so critical because, you know, they're trying to appeal to the common everyday man.
I mean, that is definitely, I think, the history that repeats itself, right? I think that every time a diverse group breaks through to something, right, there's always going to be that pushback. I think, like, women entering the workforce in general, it had a crazy effect on the American economy as well.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that they did in the U.S. when women entered the workforce, also in the 1920s, which I find interesting that Japanese women and American women seem to be entering the workforce at the same time, but women at the same time were also fighting for suffrage in the U.S. They probably were fighting for suffrage in Japan as well, but it didn't have enough momentum behind it.
Yeah.
But as soon as women entered the workforce, companies would use that as an excuse to keep wages low for everyone. Mm-hmm. So they would say to the men, well, I'm going to only pay you this much because I could have a woman do it and I can pay her that much as well. And then that creates, as you just said, resentment. And so, I don't know, it's interesting. What's one of the things, though, that I really love about Demon Slayer is that, like, Tanjiro is just so pro Nezuko. Like, he does not care about the fact that she's a woman at all. He doesn't think any less of her. Like, she's his family, like, and he loves her. And I think that's really nice.
He had such a tenderness for his whole family.
He did. It was so... I wasn't... And to be honest, like, I didn't know the plot going in.
I didn't either.
And I remember as soon as he was asked to spend the night at that guy's house, I was like, oh no, his whole family's gonna die, no! You know? But then luckily Nezuko survived, but then it was this cool thing where she's a demon and everything. I gotta say, I mean, I feel like we should wrap up this episode and then we can talk more about the show next time. But the one thing I wanna say is, like, when we went to Anime NYC, everyone was cosplayed as Demon Slayer.
Oh, so my gosh. It was really something else. Yeah. It just shows how popular it is within the cosplay and the anime community. Like, people really, really seem to dig it.
Yeah, and I hadn't seen it yet. And so I remember... Yeah. Yeah, you hadn't seen it either, right?
No.
Yeah, so I was like, what is this? Like, is it the new, like, Boku no Hero Academia or whatever? You know what I mean? But watching it, I was like, wow, no, this is a new classic that's just been born. So I'm really excited to actually get into the details of the show with you for the next episode.
Yeah. And a little fun fact... 2019, Demon Slayer actually doubled their manga sales. So it was their most successful year since the creation of the manga, which just goes to show that we really are witnessing a true anime classic. Well, thank you so much for tuning in this week.
Yeah, next week we're going to be doing part two of Demon Slayer, where we actually talk about the show. But we hope that this history was a good preface for that.
You can follow Shoujo Mojo on Instagram at Shoujo Mojo Pod. Feel free to follow us on Facebook and join our official Facebook group, Shoujo Mojo Pod Official.
If you have an anime that you want us to watch, email us at shoujomojopod@gmail.com or tweet at us at shoujomojopod.
If you enjoyed this episode, please review us on Google Podcasts. It will really help us to grow. You can also find this and all of our other episodes on Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Overcast, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
And shameless plug, if you love anime theme songs, follow my band Otaku Ngaku on Instagram and TikTok at otaku_ngaku. I actually just today recorded the Demon Slayer OP, so hopefully that'll be up by the time this episode airs.
Yeah. I can't wait.
Thanks.
We should use it as our theme song.
Yeah, we should.
Yes.
Play it right now. Bam.
Bam. And if you are looking for your next amazing cosplay or a cute Amigurumi doll, follow me on Instagram at LadyCatFashion.
All right, signing off, I'm Alexis.
And I'm Alex.
And this was Shoujo Mojo.
Kunarenu nara arigata kanashimi